I will be reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 15 to 27. But I have not used any of these rights, but I am not writing in the hope that you will do such things for me, for I would rather die than allow anyone to deprive me of this boast. For when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, since I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge, and so not make full use of my rights as a preacher of the gospel. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak, to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the prize.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here at this point. When I showed up this morning, I found Harold, and he and I looked at each other, and we both just walked across this parking lot, which was just a sheet of ice. So it was much better by the time he arrived, and so I'm grateful to be here and grateful for Harold spreading that salt on there for us this morning. We're in the book of 1 Corinthians. When Dan was preaching, he didn't continue with that, but the last 3 weeks have been the letter from Paul to the church in Corinth. And I've been trying to focus this idea particularly on this theme of freedom. So as people who have been set free by Christ, what does it then mean to exercise that freedom as followers of Jesus? And this week I want to focus on freedom as it relates to the gospel. Specifically, what does it mean to use our freedom for the sake of the gospel? What might we be willing to do or not do so that others might see God? And now if you're reading this passage and there's one line that sticks out to you, it might be that most famous of lines of Paul's, "I have become all things to all people." And I think to our 21st century ears, this might ring a little strange. You know, think about all the commencement speeches that happen in the spring to people that are going off into the world. And this seems very contrary to that advice. You have to be true to yourself, right? That's one of those most kind of common advices given to people. Go out into the world, follow your passion, be true to yourself. So when Paul says, "I have become all things to all people," it sounds a bit chameleon-like. It sounds like Paul's a bit a people pleaser. He's trying to do whatever it takes to please people. One of the reasons why I wanted to look at this passage in the context of these other passages, because if you pull this out of the larger context, it is hard to see what Paul's talking about. But if you remember 2 weeks ago, we talked about the issue that was dividing the congregation in Corinth. There was a group of believers who were considered the strong believers who considered that it was fine to eat meat sacrificed to idols. And then there was the weak believers who were having a problem with that. And we kind of expected Paul to say, the weak believers need to get over their superstition, get over their hang-ups, and be fine with these believers eating meat. But he doesn't do that. He actually asks the stronger brothers to come over and join their weaker brothers and sisters in solidarity for the good of them. So in this case, not using your freedom for your own self-gratification, but for the building up of the community. And now when we get into chapter 9, I couldn't include all this in the reading, but I just want to back up just a little bit. And Paul begins this chapter by saying, "Am I not free? Am I not an apostle?" And so what he's trying to do here is he wants to ground this argument, telling these Corinthians, this is what you need to do. He wants to ground that in his own life. And he begins by saying, "Aren't I apostle?" And he says, "Aren't I apostle because didn't I encounter the risen Lord? Don't you, in fact, exist as a church because of me?" And therefore, if Paul is a legitimate apostle, he should be granted rights. So he says, "Don't I have the right to food and drink? Don't I have the right to be married like other apostles?" And this is the big one. This is the one I want to focus on. "Don't I have the right to receive financial compensation from you for preaching the gospel?" Now, if you think about this time, there wasn't an established model for funding the work that Paul does. There wasn't a Mennonite mission group or any parachurch organization that was funding missionaries. He was basically a freelance missionary. And so the Corinthians would have probably then taken Paul and compared him to the philosophers of the day, how those philosophers supported themselves. And there was four ways that philosophers supported themselves. One, they could charge a fee. You know, the drawback of that was that the philosopher kind of was seen as kind of greedy. Number two, they could find a wealthy patron to support them. But the problem with that was that you were kind of then beholden to that patron. So whatever the patron said to do, that's kind of what you needed to do. Number three, the philosopher could beg on the streets. And number four would be that the philosopher would support themselves with a trade. And early in Paul's ministry, he chose this option, to support himself with a trade. And as you probably know, he was a tent maker, or at least that's what we think he was. Paul never tells us what he did, but Luke in Acts says that he was a tent maker. Now, to my ears today, a tent maker sounds pretty cool. It sounds like that kind of craftsman. He's that artisan craftsman fabricating tents. I have this axe that I use at my house. It was made in Sweden, and there's the initials of the person who made it, who forged it and pounded it on that axe, which I think is pretty cool. It's this artisan axe. And so I'm thinking, you know, this is a little bit like Paul, except he's got Saul of Tarsus on his tents. But this is definitely not how the Corinthians saw this work. For the Corinthians, this work was seen as pretty menial and demeaning. And Paul even seems to indicate in his letters that this work of tent making was a burden. He says in 1 Thessalonians 2:9, "Surely you remember, brothers, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be a burden to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you." And there's also this kind of a little bit enigmatic line in Galatians towards the end where Paul says, "See what large letters I make when I'm writing by my own hand." Now, let me be clear. We don't know exactly why Paul is writing large letters. There's a good chance it might have been his eyesight. A lot of people think that Paul, by this point, had poor eyesight. But I ran against one Pauline scholar, one scholar who studies Paul, who thought probably what was happening at this point was that Paul's hands were so gnarled from the work of tent making, from drawing that thread through the heavy linen, that it became hard for him to write those letters. My dad's dad, my grandpa, was a school teacher. And when he started having kids, he stopped doing that and he started laying carpet. He needed to make more money to support his family. And he did that for a long, long time. I think 30 or 40 years he laid carpet. When I was a kid, when I'd sit by my grandpa, I was always fascinated by his hands because he had these massive calluses on him. And if you can imagine why, when you're laying carpet, you're down on your hands, you're kneeling, and you do that for 30 or 40 years, you develop some pretty rough hands, some pretty big calluses. And this way, my grandpa's work was actually written on his hands. You could look at his hands, and you had a sense of what he did to support his family. And this idea of Paul's gnarled fingers gives me this sense that Paul could kind of hold up his hands and say, this is what I sacrifice for the gospel. The work of Paul in preaching the gospel is actually written on his hands and fingers that were not quite right. And the fact that Paul was doing this toilsome work would have been controversial to the Corinthians because it was not in line with what they saw a true wise person does. And that then began to lead them to start questioning Paul's apostleship. In 2 Corinthians, Paul actually addresses this directly when he says, did I commit a sin by humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I proclaimed God's good news to you free of charge? And in this letter, that's why he starts out in chapter 9 by saying two things. Haven't I encountered the risen Christ? And don't you exist? In which he calls kind of the seal of his apostleship. Because of this work Paul was doing, they were questioning his apostleship, and he felt like he needed to defend himself. So Paul says, because I'm a legitimate apostle, I have rights to financial support, but I didn't claim that right. Now, why didn't Paul claim this right to be supported? He felt somehow that if he were to receive money from the Corinthians, that would be a hindrance to proclaiming the gospel. You think about it, if he would have had a wealthy patron in the church support him, he would have been beheld to that patron. And Paul says in verse 16, yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. So something's compelling Paul, but it's not a wealthy patron. It's God. He owes his life and existence to God, and that is then what compels Paul to preach this gospel. And in doing so, he gives up his right to money, to receive money for his ministry. And this way, Paul is actually taking a step down the social ladder. He's using his freedom, his rights to receive financial compensation, not to elevate himself, but actually to lower himself. Now, where would Paul have gotten this model from? Well, he actually lays out this paradigm, this model, most clearly in Philippians 2, which is probably a well-familiar verse to you. Let me read that about Jesus' life. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was the form of God, did not regard equality as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness and being found in human form. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Why is Paul willing to renounce these rights? Why is he willing to lower himself? Why is he willing to become a slave to all? Because he's patterning his life off of Jesus' life. When you think about whatever rights Paul gave up, seemed pretty minuscule when he would have compared himself to Jesus, who was with God and gave up that right to come down and be a servant to man. So in this sense, Paul is not just preaching the gospel, he's modeling the gospel with his life. He's embodying the gospel, quite literally. You know, we hear that term a lot, how to embody the gospel. I think in this case, through his work, Paul is literally embodying the gospel message. You know that old saying, you can't just talk the talk, you've got to walk the walk. I think this is one of the ways Paul was doing. He wasn't just proclaiming this gospel with his mouth, with his hands, with his body. Now, if we go to verse 19 through 23, Paul has now laid out his goal. And that goal is to proclaim the gospel to as many people as possible, to win over as many people as possible to this gospel. And now he's going to actually work that out through his behavior. One of the ways he does that is with his toil, but another way is he adapts his behavior. Now, it's clear, and I read this line at first, I think it's important to realize that Paul is adapting his behavior, not his message. He's not taking a different message to each of these groups, the Jews, the Gentiles, the weak, but he is adapting his behavior. So he says these four things: to the Jew, I became a Jew. To those under the law, I became one under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law. And to the weak, I became weak. So Paul is talking about working to overcome cultural and ethnic divisions, to bring these various groups of people together in one community. In this sense, he's meeting people where they are in order to bring them into this new community of faith. And these first ones have to do with the Jew-Gentile issue, which was so present in Paul's day, of how do you bring these Jews and Gentiles together. But he seems to be, actually, the main lead-up seems to be this fourth one of to the weak, I become weak. Because you think about it, that language of weak, if you remember from the last couple weeks, that then reminds us, oh, this is what the weak believers. So we need to remember that Paul is writing this to the Corinthians and to the ones who have this knowledge, who are the strong believers, and asking them to become weak. And again, he's grounding that argument in his own life of how he became weak for the weak. Now, what would that actually look like for the Corinthians? What would that actually mean to relinquish a right? Well, one of the ways it might have meant is that if you were wealthy and you had privilege and you were not able to then go to some of these banquets where this meat was served that was sacrificed to idols, how many times can you do that before it starts to come as a cost? I think you can kind of understand that even today. And how many invitations to certain business groups can you turn down before it comes at a cost? I think that's what Paul was saying to this group. Are you willing to renounce that right to go to these banquets and eat this meat for the sake of your fellow brothers and sisters? Now, what does that mean to relinquish our rights today for the gospel? You can think of some huge examples. You know, people have given up their entire lives to go move around the world to proclaim the gospel. But let's think about our daily lives. What are we willing to do to give up to so that others might see God for the sake of the gospel? I was reading a book recently by a Mennonite pastor in Kansas, and he tells a story about a guy who started engaging with a family down the road and was having these really invigorating conversations with him, with the father sitting across. And they were great conversations. The challenge for him was that the father was a chain smoker, and that these long conversations made him literally sick the next day. And he tells a story about how over time, engaging with this family, they were eventually welcomed into the congregation. And he talks about how, you know, in this sense, proclaiming the gospel literally made him sick. I think about examples just in our daily life of time. So often it's our time that inhibits us from showing God to other people. We're often in a hurry. What does it mean to take 5 minutes to hear somebody's story, to hear your coworker's stories, to hear your neighbor down the street's story? I don't think we often know what we need to relinquish for the sake of the gospel. And I think that's often why we need to just pray, God, show me, what do I need to give up? I don't always know what I need to give up. Show me what I need to give up so that others might see you. And then to listen to those nudgings. Because once you do that, if you start praying that regularly, it's surprising what you start noticing. Situations that you might not have ever noticed before, all of a sudden you can notice them because you're tuning your mind. You're opening yourself up to engaging with others. In his final paragraph, Paul then turns to athletes in training to win a race. I'll read these verses again. If you want to follow, they're verses 24 through 27. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body, and I make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. So during these last few chapters in Corinthians, we've dealt with some foreign stuff that's culturally very foreign to us. This should be a metaphor of Paul's that's very, very familiar with us, especially this week. You think about what kicked off this week. It was the Olympic Games in South Korea. I think about what is it that fascinates us so much about the Olympic Games. I think a lot of it is that we are captivated by these men and women who devote their entire lives in this pursuit of the gold medal, because that's what it typically takes to be the best in the world at something. And so we find ourselves watching these sports that otherwise we probably would never watch, that we could care less about. If you watched the Super Bowl last Sunday, if you didn't watch it, great. If you did, like I did, that's okay too. But there was an advertisement for the Olympics that included Lindsey Vonn. And if you don't know who Lindsey Vonn is, she is arguably the greatest downhill skier of all time. If you look at what her World Cup titles are, she's possibly the greatest downhill skier of all time. But in this one-minute video that NBC shows, it starts out with her, Lindsey, as a little girl, and it starts flashing back and forth between her as a girl and then her as an adult skier. And then one of the things it does is it shows some of her kind of wild crashes down the mountain. And Lindsey has taken some serious spills, and one of them, she's actually being lifted up by the helicopter off the mountain to the hospital. So it shows both, one, this kind of lifetime pursuit of the goal, and it also shows the kind of the challenge that comes with when you pursue this. The other thing it shows is just the pure discipline it takes to be an Olympian. The hours and hours, 6 days a week, 8 hours a day of training to be the best in the world. And the video zooms in a couple times on her knee and her elbow, and you can see the scars. You can see on her body the toll that pursuing gold has taken. And what I liked about this video is that it gives a really good snapshot of what it takes to be an Olympian athlete. So Paul ends this section by saying, think about the athlete. Think about the athlete's dedication to this goal. It's a life of discipline, of sacrifice, of training, focus, and grit. And he says, as you look at this, as you look at the Olympic Games, don't look at the spectator, look at the athlete as kind of your model. You know, think about what's required of the spectator. Not a huge amount, you're rather passive in nature. He's saying, look at the athlete, look at the discipline, the training, the grit, and then use that as your model for pursuing the Christian life. And the reason he used this image of a runner was because of these games that happen every other year and were second only to the Olympic Games, called the Isthmian Games. And as these runners competed in these games, they would win a crown. But it was made out of celery, withered celery, so it was literally a perishable crown. And Paul is trying to make the argument, if these athletes are willing to dedicate this much time and energy and focus for a crown that is perishable, that withers, how much more are you willing to do for the sake of the gospel? About 15 years ago, I was spending the night at about 18,000 feet up in the crater of Mount Kilimanjaro. If you're familiar with Mount Kilimanjaro, it's the highest point in the continent of Africa. It's a volcano, and then within that volcano is three high points. So I was spending the night at 18,000 feet on day six of a 7-day trek up the mountain, and I had the worst headache I've ever had in my life. If you've ever been up at, you know, even 10, 12, 13, 14,000 feet, the air gets thin, and it gets hard to breathe. You start getting these throbbing headaches. We had just spent the day before with a group of my friends traversing the Great Western Breach, which is this 2,500-foot ascent up this volcano into the crater of Kilimanjaro. The next day we woke up, walked up to Uhura Peak, which is at 19,336 feet, and at that point I was standing on literally the top of the continent. And I looked back at my journal this week as I was thinking about this, and I saw that it was a euphoric moment for me, is what I described it. I'd spent, you know, a number of months training for it. I'd spent quite a bit of money to get to that point. I'd been dreaming about it for a couple years. And at this moment, standing up on this mountain, I felt this euphoric feeling. I then started moving down the mountain, And about 50 yards from that point, I walked by, and a guide was doing CPR on another guy who was doing the mountain. And at that moment, I knew without a doubt that this guy was dead. I mean, there was no way at that altitude that this guy was going to survive. So I'm moving from this kind of euphoric moment to just minutes later, watching somebody who had just was dying on this mountain. It all just seemed a little bit silly. My own thirst for adventure seemed in some ways just a little bit silly. Not that I regretted climbing the mountain, but all of a sudden in that moment, it put it in perspective. It was a perishable crown. I'd spent all this money and time and energy to go up and tag a summit. And when I got to the top, I realized the prize was perishable. And Paul is saying there's lots of crowns that the world and life will offer you. But don't spend your whole life running after one and finally get it and then realize it's perishable. Realize that it's just withered celery. Paul is saying link your life to something and someone that is worth living and dying for. If an athlete is willing to push themselves to the limit for a withered vegetables, how much more should we maintain our self-discipline for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of our brothers and sisters in Christian community, for the sake of those who do not know God, for the sake that is of a crown that is not made of withered vegetables, but one that is imperishable. Please pray with me. Gracious Father, we thank you for Paul's example of what he was willing to do for the sake of the gospel, Lord. And we ask that you open us up, open up our hearts to what you would have us both give up and do for your kingdom, Lord, so that others might see you and might see your Son. In Jesus' name, amen.